This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa usalli wa usallam ala Sayyidil Awwaleen wal Akhireen, Nabiyyina Muhammadin wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa barak wa sallam. All praise are due to Allah, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our beloved Prophet Muhammad, the master of the first and the last, his family, his companions, and all those who call to his way and establish his sunnah to the day of judgment. As to what follows, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Alhamdulillah, this is another of our sessions on minarets and thrones. And it is the relationship of scholars to the rulers. And this relationship is critical. It's critical for the movement of the community and that synergy when the two power forces, the ones controlling the dunya and then the ones leading to the akhirah, the next life, when these two forces come together, then leadership is complete. And sometimes if we have one and not the other, there's some good things happen, but it's not really the type of achievements that we find when both sides are working together. And that is part of the tawheed, in a sense, the unity, which is so critical for Muslims and in how we move. And we will find out that leadership, the Muslim world has gone through a lot of changes. And we're talking about over 1400 years and all over the world, all types of races, religions, nationalities who have entered Islam, different classes of people, different experiences. And so it's complex. And we are trying to look at this complexity to take out the best of it, to show where the brilliance came. And sometimes, strangely enough, you can find positive and negative even within the same individual. And our job really is to follow the positive, to be aware of the negative, but also to celebrate the positive achievements made by certain individuals, because really they were used by Allah in order to carry things out. And so the basic concept of tawheed, wahada yuwahidu, which means to make things one, that can be looked at in a lot of ways. Of course, the basis is monotheism, which is our belief in one God and not many different gods, because that would be polytheism. But there's also the tawheed of the human family, that we as a race, we as Homo sapiens sapiens, that we are actually one family. Even though people see themselves today as very much different based upon where they live or the color of their skin or their language or whether tall or short. But if you go through the skin of people and, you know, there's been scientific experiments done and investigation done that when you take a person from Africa and China and Europe and you put them together, different races, and, you know, when you go beneath the skin, when you take out the differences of the facial structure, the nose, the skin color, and you go beneath the surface, you find that people are basically the same. The internal organs are not European organs or African organs or Asian organs. They are the organs, the internal part of a human being. And so, because one human being. Okay, so that's where the tawheed comes in. Tawheed also comes in with the unity of knowledge. And that is that we believe all knowledge comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There's not some knowledge as what we find today in the secular modernistic world, where they cut out the concept of the Creator and they try to divide church from state, spiritual things from material things. That didn't happen in the Muslim world. And unfortunately today, because our countries were conquered by European colonial powers and our educational systems were changed, many Muslims still have this concept in mind that there's a difference between religion and politics, or religion and economics, the masjid and the state. But originally, in the time of the Prophet ﷺ, there was no division. So that tawheed is critical for us. And today we want to look at knowledge, the broad sense of knowledge. Because when people think of knowledge, sometimes they think the ulama, they only think that the knowledge of revelation. And the knowledge of revelation definitely is primary knowledge. That's the basic knowledge. But the knowledge of the world, the signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, is also a form of revelation. And in the Quran itself, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in speaking about the bees, and it says, وَأَوْحَى اللَّهُ إِلَى النَّحْلِ, that Allah revealed to the bee certain types of knowledge. So the fact that the bees are able to gather from flowers and the things that they do, it's based on revelation. Or you could say, inspiration. Then there is the formal revelation that comes from Allah to the angel Jibreel and then to the prophets. Okay, that is a special type of revelation. But there are other forms of revelation. Revelation is even used in the case of Maryam, may Allah be pleased with her, the mother of Isa alayhi salam, mother of Jesus. It's also mentioned wahi, that she received wahi because she was inspired. And you even had some scholars, they're a tiny minority, but they said because that word wahi is used for Maryam, that you could include her in the prophets. That is a minority position, because wahi is also used with the bees. So you can't include bees with the prophets, but it's inspiration. So there's different types of inspiration where Allah Azza wa Jal gives knowledge and guidance directly to a creature. So the wahi that came to Maryam to go outside the city to shake the palm tree, whatever, that is directly from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The knowledge that came to the bees is directly from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so with this concept in mind of knowledge, we want to look at the relationship of one of the rulers of Islam and the ulama and the scholars. And this Khalifa or Caliph, Abu al-Abbas Abdullah al-Ma'mun, and we ran into him before, looking at the Abbasid period. And he was born in 786, and he was one of the great Khalifas, and he was the son of Harun al-Rashid. And Harun al-Rashid was known to be one of the greatest of Abbasid rulers, and maybe the richest man. Some say he may be the richest man who ever lived, okay, in terms of just materials. His power is not like Nabi Sulaiman, alayhi salam, because he had more than just materials, right? And but Al-Ma'mun, he had a strong education from when he was young. He learned the Quran, he learned fiqh, and he was living at a time when the books of the Europeans were being translated, because Muslims had been in contact with the world, and information was coming in. And so some of the texts were being translated. Some of their scholars were either embracing Islam, or they were going to Baghdad, because Baghdad was one of the leading cities in the world at the time, especially for the spread of knowledge. And so he was very much into knowledge. And he started reading the books of the Europeans. And that's especially the Greeks and the Romans, and that is especially philosophy, falsafa. And the philosophy is really where people start projecting themselves into things, sometimes that are unknown, right? And so he actually had a reputation as not only just a leader, but he was a debater. He would debate. He was involved in a lot of scholarly type of projects. And it's interesting because even though he was of the Abbasids, his mother was a Persian slave or right-hand possession. I didn't get a chance to change the word concubine because I took this text from out of some, but concubine is not a good word actually to use. It's more like a bonded servant. But the fact is, when you think of slave, you think of somebody who's in a plantation being beaten by the Romans or by, you know, the whites beating, you know, the blacks. No, this is a person who lived in luxury and who actually was eventually freed and married the Khalifa. And she was the mother of Ma'mun. So in America, in the West, if you were a slave, you could never make it up to the upper class. Impossible. Okay, so this is a different concept. So the word slavery is not even a good word to use because it's so different. It's just somebody controlled by somebody else. But it's not how we know slavery today when we use the term. Anyhow, the key point is that in reading these Greek, Roman, and other philosophical texts, he started to question a lot of things. And he became part of a movement, which is sort of a like rationalist movement. They want to try to figure everything out, because the Greeks were trying to do that. They were trying to figure everything out. And so they went into Islamic theology. And there are some aspects of theology, which is ilm al-ghayb. It is the knowledge of the unseen. So we don't know that. And the great scholars, when they came to points that they didn't know, they would say, Allahu alam, Allah knows best. Okay? But this group, the Mu'tazila, they started to question everything, and they infected actually the Khalifa himself. Not his whole life, but he got involved in this. And one of the controversial things that they said was the Quran was created. It was like a created being, like walking and talking, you know, type of being. And the scholars of Islam disagreed with this because the Quran is Kalamullah al-Munazzil. It is the words of Allah that was revealed to the Prophet through the angel. That's our definition. Okay, but they try to do it, you know, they try to figure it out. And they couldn't handle something that they couldn't put in material terms, you see? But the problem was, because he had state power and he was a influential person, he wanted everybody to believe in this. And the scholars refused to believe. Some, of course, did accept it, but you know, the serious scholars refused. And at the head of them was Imam Ahmed ibn Hanbal, rahimahullah. And he refused. And Ma'mun, having state power, and sometimes power gets to your head, he actually persecuted some of the scholars. He brought them to Baghdad, in some cases, you know, like prisoners. And many of them then changed their opinion, but Imam Ahmed never did. And he actually suffered. And to the point where the Mujahideen who were fighting in the battle, they were calling the name of Imam Ahmed. So it reached the point where Ma'mun then, who wasn't totally unreasonable person, then, you know, he lightened up. And after his time, after he passed away, everything changed. Because it was really philosophy. So philosophy is not the main part of people's lives. That's generally, you know, the knowledge of people who are on that level of debating philosophical things. So that was one part of Ma'mun. But the other part of Ma'mun was the fact that he was heavily involved in scholarship. And this was something where you have that coming together, because he is the ruler of a vast empire. And it was probably the largest city on earth. They were the richest people on earth. And here he is, having unlimited amount of gold and silver and power and authority. He loves knowledge. So he got involved in retrieving knowledge. And it was known that he loved books so much that if you came with a new book of some significance, he'd give you the weight in gold. So people, it's like a revolution that happened. Because sometimes people, scholars, historians, they can't believe the achievements that Muslims made. Because today we know, what do we know Muslims as? Just they blow things up and, you know, they're extremists. How could they have made these achievements? I mean, the Romans, the Greeks, the Renaissance, but in that period called the Dark Ages, how could the Muslims have made achievements such as this? Okay? This is not superstition. It's not magic. You can see how it came together. And the basis of that was that the ruler came together with the scholars. And what he did was he started this revolution, and it was purchasing knowledge, hunting for knowledge, and also translation. So they were not restricted to Arabic or Persian. Persian was one of the main languages. Of course, at the time, the Abbasids coming out of the Persian area. So Farsi was a court language and it was an important written language. They weren't stuck with this. They actually would go to different languages and get translators who would translate from the Greek or the Latin or even ancient Sanskrit spoken in India and into Arabic. So this is something amazing now, because you're not destroying people. Like when the Mongols came, they just burnt all the books, killed all the scholars. They didn't care. And sometimes they would use people, but they would use that to build up their army and to do certain things. But this was different, okay? And so knowledge was critical. And he developed, along with the scholars, he developed what you call today, it's like a think tank. It's like a modern university think tank called Bayt al-Hikmah, the House of Wisdom. Okay, and it was in this House of Wisdom, which is like a university. If you think of the universities today, you think of Harvard, MIT, you think of McGill, you know, Sorbonne. I mean, they get scholars from all around the world. They give you a scholarship. So if you look in some of these universities, you'll find in engineering department, you're going to find Egyptians and other people like that. If you look in medical departments, you'll find Indian, Pakistanis, you know, other people, not Europeans. But you're under their system, right? They finance you, you see? So they get the benefit from you. And they use you and they make achievements. These achievements that are here, flying in planes and all of these things, go back and see who are the ones that did it. You'll be surprised to know that many of the inventions, and you'll be shocked to see inventions made by Afro-Americans.
Like Microsoft.
Yeah, but even before that. The Microsoft, even Apple, you know, the whole thing of Apple and, you know, whatnot. Abdul Fattah, I mean, he was basically a Syrian Arab. So you're going to see how many achievements. So this is what happened. They set the pace for this. Nobody else had done anything like this before. So it caused a major revolution in knowledge that not only the Muslims benefit from, but the whole world benefited from. And from that, the whole scientific method that you know now, the science, you know, where you investigate something and you prove, you know, go to a higher level or whatever, all of that is during this period. Okay? They took the theories of the past and they made precise experiments. They applied it. You see, they didn't discover all that knowledge. They just took the discoveries of the people before and they applied it to their times. That was their achievement. You see? And Ma'mun, who was a very rational person, very organized person, he now put the power of the state behind this revolution in knowledge. Okay? So this is how some of the texts would look at the time. You know, Greek, Chinese, Sanskrit, Persian, Syriac, they were going through all the different languages that housed knowledge. And they were putting it into Arabic. So if you knew Arabic at the time, you could be exposed to a lot of things. When Islam first came out, Arabic was basically the Quran, the Hadith, the scholars of the Wahi, the revelation. Now, Arabic was also the language of science. Because for the Muslims, we didn't separate it. So you'd have an Islamic scholar who would finish his tafsir of the Quran, and then he'd pick up his book on mathematics. Then he studies fiqh, jurisprudence, and then he does a little chemistry. You see? They didn't separate like today. Today you got chemistry department, sciences, humanities, you know, religious department. The Europeans divided everything up. Okay, that's the dilemma that, you know, society is in today. So this is the Bayt al-Hikmah. This is an artist's conception of Baghdad. You know, how it was, how it looked. It was an achievement, even the city itself. It was set up scientifically in terms of everything was organized. And Bayt al-Hikmah, this of course is an artist's conception of what it was like, but it was there in the Tigris and Euphrates region, and Bayt al-Hikmah was there. So Ma'mun got involved in a lot of things. Now some of his achievements, right, working with the scholars, he would commission groups to do things, commission scholars. Just like today, they'll give you a grant. So they say, okay, you want to study this certain virus, or you want to study these plants, whatever, we'll give you a grant of, you know, $500,000, and you just devote your life to study. That's the reason why they can do so much. And that's why many of our scholars in the Muslim world right now, they can't do too much because they're trying to eat food. They end up being the chancellor of the university signing documents all day instead of research. Whereas the people who have the money in back of them, they can do the research. So some of the things that he did, and some amazing things, just some examples. He commissioned the mapping of the world. Okay, because nobody had a full map of the world. Right? And there were some pieces that were in some of the ancient texts, but he wanted to put it all together. And they actually had a basic concept of the size of the earth. So this whole thing about the earth is flat and Columbus's time and all that, Muslims already knew it was round. That's not something that came about with Europeans. Okay? He also went into what is called Egyptology. And this is interesting for a lot of people who study ancient Egypt. Many African Americans, you know, study ancient Egypt as an African country. He went deep into Egyptology, the pyramids, to try to understand how they built the pyramids. You know, what? Because many people overlook ancient Egyptian society. I had the chance to go in the underneath the pyramids and to visit that area. And history, because it's based on European thinking, right? It denies what happened in Egypt. But way back in 3200 BC, they had united their society. And shortly after that, 2500, they're building pyramids, which has millions of blocks of granite. It has right angles. It has all the scientific thing. Where did they get that from? So one European came along and he said it was aliens. And they flew down on Earth. You see that on the internet all the time. And they built the pyramids, right? Because black people couldn't do that, right? There's no way Africans could do something like that. Right, there's all kinds of documentaries. Yeah, and some people get serious about this because they say they couldn't have done this. Because if you say that Africans did this, because there was no Europeans, no Asians at that time in Egypt, Cleopatra was not a Greek girl. Right? If you say that Africans did something like this before the Greeks even started their society, then your whole racist theory is out the window. You see? So he was so open-minded that he even wanted to understand the pyramids, and he started to build astronomical observatories. Do some amazing things were done in astronomy in so many different areas. It's mind-boggling. And I just want to give you a taste of some of this tonight. And some of what he was doing, which is another amazing thing that you see the Europeans do, is that he would send out expeditions of scholars to find knowledge. So if they said, okay, in China there's particular knowledge there, he would outfit the group and they would go to China. And they would meet the people and try to find out what it is and then bring it back. And even Constantinople, the European lands, anywhere they could find it. So this is what they were doing. They were bringing it all back into this house of wisdom. So it was amazing. And so you could say that this was really the first international university. Okay, this set the pace for universities all around the world. Now, the scholar. There were different scholars, but probably the most important scholar who interfaced with Ma'mun. Because remember, we're talking about rulers and scholars, right? So the most important was Muhammad ibn Musa al-Khwarizmi. And he was a Persian man who was born in the area of Khwarizm, which is now present-day Uzbekistan and in this region, Central Asian region, okay? And he was trained in traditional Persian scholarship, of course, learned Arabic and whatnot. He focused heavily on mathematics and astronomy and natural sciences. So, and he was a brilliant person. He was an achiever. And they say that he was fluent in Arabic, Persian, possibly Greek too. They say he was reading Sanskrit. And Sanskrit is the ancient Indian language. And a lot of early things actually came out of Sanskrit. And you'll see some of the texts that he actually wrote, okay, coming out of this knowledge that Khwarizmi had. And Ma'mun really focused on him and gave him a lot of his support. And he was one of the primary people. Probably the most famous thing that Al-Khwarizmi did was the fact that, you know, Ma'mun, in trying to repair the city and organize and control Baghdad, you need to break things down into sections. Half, quarter, eighth, sixteenth, you know, whatever. Inheritance. How do you do inheritance? If somebody's got a big family. If you are, you know, organizing the city, how do you divide it up? So many things you need this, for way of calculating things. So he commissioned Al-Khwarizmi, okay? So, and he studied it, and he wrote a book where he dealt with this. It was called Kitab al-Mukhtasa fi Hisab al-Jabr wal-Muqabala. Okay, so that means the abbreviated book on calculation by completion and balancing. Okay? But look at the Arabic there. I mean, you can see the actual text on your right. So that's how the Arabic texts were kind of looking at those days. But if you look at this, look at the transliteration. Kitab al-Mukhtasar, right? Abbreviated book. Fi Hisab al-Jabr. You see it? You see the word? Hisab al-Jabr. Algebra. That's where the word algebra comes from. Ask the average Canadian, American, European, where did algebra come from? They would say Greece. The Greeks. It's an Arabic word. They would be in shock if they knew that algebra is an Arabic word. It's literally taken from this work done by Al-Khwarizmi. Okay? And they use that for the divisions, finances, zakat, construction, agriculture, navigation, booty distribution, all kinds of things they use this for. It was an amazing achievement. And algebra now has led to so much in this world, is based upon these calculations. This is amazing work that he actually did. Another interesting thing that he did, he was one of the lead scholars in trying to deal with the map of the world. Okay? And so they gathered together the maps that the Arab traders had, that the Greeks had, that the Romans, different people who traveled, Phoenicians, wherever they get the maps, they put them all together. And they did an actual map of the world. They mapped out the known world at that time and some amazing things he did on this map. And I was surprised once. I even was shocked. I was in Australia. And normally when I go to different countries, I don't just go to a conference or something. So I go to the library, to the museums and other places like this, right? So I wanted to know about the history of Australia. And what is the history of Muslims in Australia? And you'd be surprised to know, they're not just recent people who came here. When the British first opened up, they took over the land and stole it from the Aboriginal people. And they needed to go through the center of the country. They use Afghan caravaners. So the Afghans opened up the middle of Australia. And the routes that the Afghans made are now the major highways going through the country. It's an interesting story. There's even some traces. Some of the Afghans' families are still there. Some of them returned. They're Afghans and Pathans. You know, so some of them returned. Some of them are there. It's an interesting story. So I was trying to find out the history of Islam in Australia, and I came across this work done in the university. And they said, the oldest map of Australia was in Arabic. It's in the university in Australia. It's in Arabic. And I realized this is Al-Khwarizmi. And how he described Australia, they described it at the time. They said, our sailors reached this island and they couldn't find the other end of the island. Right, it was the biggest island they ever saw before. And they were describing Australia. And it was mostly at that time the north coast, because you come from Indonesia, like you go right into Australia. So his map with Australia is the oldest map of that country. And the average Australian does not know this. They would never know that the oldest map of Australia is in Arabic. It's in Arabic. Al-Khwarizmi who did it. Hunayn also wrote a treatise, Ophthalmology, right? And there were scholars who dealt with smallpox, infections, surgery. Some amazing things were actually being done during this time, you know, by the scholars in Bayt al-Hikmah. Amazing things. And these are some of the advancements that were made. It was mainly there, but it's also in other places too, because there were great scholars in Al-Andalus, in Toledo and Granada, and also North Africa, and, you know, different parts of the Muslim world. They were great scholars. But the center of a lot of this, especially in that part of the world, was there in Baghdad. Okay, in the western part of the world, the center was in Al-Andalus. There. So, but these are some of the sciences now that came out of, that were began by Muslims. Algebra, we know this. Anesthesia, biology, botany, cardiology, chemistry, dermatology, embryology, emergency medicine, geology, metallurgy, modern surgery, modern medicine, modern arithmetic, optics, parasitology, pharmacology, pulmonary medicine, toxicology, urology. This is like a university. These were began by Muslims. In other words, there was a lot of theories around before, and they made it into an applied science. Okay? They didn't discover all the things from nowhere. It's not hocus pocus. They're not flying on carpets. Right? That's the fairy tales. Right? They took knowledge and they put it together. Some of the substances and devices that were introduced into Europe by Muslims. A lot of these came from Baghdad. There's a famous story of Az-Ziryab, who came into, he was from Baghdad, and he came into Andalusia. And, you know, he brought, you know, a lot of scientific things, you know, there, and, you know, he, for a lot of things from Baghdad, he brought over. But look at today now, what this explosion of knowledge actually did, okay? And this was brought into Europe. Europeans didn't have these things before. Pendulums, the clocks, right? Cotton, paper, okay? Chinese had paper. Egyptians had papyrus, and the Chinese had it. But the Muslims now, in their contact with the Chinese, they you know, brought Chinese, and they revolutionized paper. Okay, and glass mirrors. They didn't have that before. Crystal, street lamps, colored glass, satin, pepper, paper money. Think about this. Postage stamps, book binding. Clocks, soap. Just imagine if we didn't give them soap, right? What would have happened? Soap, man. They didn't even have a way to bathe themselves with soap until the Muslims in Andalusia showed them how to bathe. Astrolabes, compasses, slide rules, flasks, surgical instruments, windmill, artificial teeth. Imagine if they didn't have teeth, artificial teeth. Spinning wheels for textiles, globes, citrus fruits, eyeglasses, porcelain, gunpowder, cables, velvet, almanacs, encyclopedias. That was the Google of this age, right? Before many of us who were born before computers, before the 90s, you got to have an almanac, encyclopedia, right? Before you could Google things. The word almanac is almanach. It's an Arabic word, literally. Okay? Saddles and also leather shoes. Now, Walt Taylor, an American scholar, he recorded 1,000 English words of Arabic origin. These are some of the words. Admiral comes from Amir al-Bahar. Think about this, you're Admiral of the Navy, right? Alcohol, alcohol, alcove, al-qubba, there's algebra. A logarithm, the algorithms, right, which are so important today. It's al-Khwarizmi's name. You know how important the algorithm is today? Some people live with the algorithms. Some people, artificial intelligence is like their new god. The name is from Arabic. How many people know this? Almanach, almanac. Amber is anba. Arsenal, Dar as-Sinaa. Assassin, Hashashin, now that sounds like you Muslims. Right? Assassin, right? Hashashin. Right? Because of Hassan al-Sabah and the group, the Ismailis, right? Kalaba from Qalib. Camphor is Kafur. Check of the Bank of Montreal. Sec. Chemistry from Alchemia. Cotton is Qutun. Lemon is from Lemoon. Magazine. Right? Time Magazine, McLean's. Makhazan. Mattress is Matrah. Monsoon is Mosim. Sugar is Sukar. Syrup is Sharab. Typhoon is Tufan. And Zero is Sifa. I was in this program one time in Detroit. This is before September 11th, and, you know, Muslims were nice guys at that time and whatnot. And so the police chief was there, and the mayor of the town was there. It was a big program for the Muslims, right? So I was one of the speakers. No, it was in Detroit. They were part of it. So then I said at the beginning, wanted to lighten up the atmosphere. And I said I wanted to welcome all the people there. I said, you know, I wanted to welcome, you know, the Amir of Detroit and also the Sharif of Detroit. And everybody's looking at me like, what is this, man? And then I showed them that the word mayor comes from Amir. That's what the word mayor comes from. And the Sharif was the one who had the gun. And that becomes sheriff. So the sheriff of Detroit was there. Sheriff is an Arabic word, sharif. Shocking. This explosion came about, you know, when the scholars came together with the rulers, and Ma'mun and Khwarizmi, they were probably the best example of this coming together of the two important leadership peoples. Okay, so I want to open up the floor for any discussions, any questions that anybody may have, you know, concerning these texts and concerning what happened during this time. Floor is open.
Who started to hide all these information, the Muslim United, British or American, from people knowing this?
Yeah, I mean, it really begins with the Crusades. It starts from there. Because the Crusades, and that's going back to the 11th century when they burst out of Europe, right? And they said that the Muslims are devil worshippers and we have to save the true cross of Christ. And so they went into the Muslim world, brought back information, and they started changing everything. They wouldn't tell the common people where they got it from. So from back then it started. But really, in the modern form now, it's the colonial period, you know, it's really from the 1800s, you know, when they conquered Muslim lands and they took over educational systems and, you know, then they started changing things. Okay, but in their Renaissance period, actually, yeah, step back a little bit, because the rebirth of knowledge is 15th century, 16th century, it's the Renaissance of Europe. And so what they did was, instead of saying that the major book in medicine in the Renaissance was a book called Al-Qanun fi Tib, the Law of Medicine, which was done by Ibn Sina, right, a Muslim, they say Avicenna.
Oh, yeah.
You'll see it written, Avicenna. Okay? One of the great ulama and philosophers, he even preserved a lot of the Greek philosophy, was Ibn Rushd. Ibn Rushd, great scholar, but also went to philosophy. They call Averroes. Averroes. So you're going to see when you go back to the Renaissance, a lot of the names that are actually there, they changed the Muslim name. Because they didn't want people to think that it was actually a Muslim, they Latinized it. You see? So they did this in order to cover up the knowledge.
Didn't the astronomy write this off?
Right. So you'll see this happening because all the different, look at the areas that we started the sciences. You know, Isaac Newton, they say the gravity, you know, but that, you know, but the apple hit him in his head. And they say the apple hit him in his head, and then he said, oh no, there's some force. Muslims already knew about gravity, man. He was probably sitting under the tree, and the apple hit him in his head, and he turned to the page on gravity in the Arabic text, right? And then translated it into English. Because one of the big things that happened in Spain, because that's where a lot of the knowledge went directly to Europe, especially the city called Toledo. Toledo was the center of translation. They translated a lot of the texts there. Oxford University, the person who began Oxford University, he literally came with Arabic books, and they translated it, and that was the beginning of Oxford University. And you can even go in some of the old libraries there, and you'll still see some Arabic things being used in these universities. Okay, so it's been a process. The whole rebirth of European civilization is a hoax. It wasn't the Dark Ages and then they suddenly came to light. Muslims kept the knowledge alive and then put it in a practical form. And then the Europeans benefited from it, translated, and then they made their progress, no doubt about it. But their problem is they lie. They won't tell the people where it came from. Right? And this is an injustice that they have done. And it's coming to the surface. Any questions online?
Yes. So I have a quick, the fact that Islamic thinkers could benefit from knowledge coming from India, Persia, Greeks, and Romans indicates that Indo-Greek and Persian philosophy has value. Does it have value?
It definitely has value. Because one of the texts, I'll give you an example, one of the texts written by Al-Khwarizmi, you know, because he was into Sanskrit and all that, and they had this big think tank meeting, and they wanted to revolutionize their number system. Okay? So they went into the Sanskrit because in ancient Hindi in India, they had zero. The Egyptians had zero too, but that wasn't available. But in the Hindi, in this system, they had zero, and so he wrote a text on this, and you'll see from the Hindi letters, it now 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, they put from the Hindi into Arabic. Right? And then from the Arabic, that's where you get your numbers from. Right? So there was value. It wasn't hocus pocus. No jinni taught them zero. It was known by people in India and in Egypt. So they just took it and they made it practical. And everybody started multiplying by, you know, in a different way instead of the Roman numerals. You got to start stringing, you know, numbers across the room. So this is a revolutionized math, you know, by doing that. Question online. Any other general question? Yeah, yeah.
Systems that we have, like how we go to work, how much time we spend at work, mm-hmm. and like that we're forced to kind of separate like our day into different sections, or if it's just like, you know, that maybe like back then that they had more barakah in their time so that they were able to achieve more.
So the question is, how could they achieve so much in using their time when today we have difficulties? I mean, one, we have a lot of distractions. So these distractions, especially now with social media, we have a lot of distractions, and then also the so-called modern society, you know, the pressure that they put on people just to survive, and the taxes and all the things. Life was more simple in those days. Didn't mean they couldn't make progress, but they could focus on things because they had less distractions, right? And then, as you say, they used their time wisely.
It was watching a documentary last night on India, right? when they go there, right, they were surprised there was no poor people. And India at that time, everybody was wealthy, everybody was well doing. And he came back and he spoke to the king at that time, I can't remember the name of the king. He said, these people are self-sufficient. We got to do something.
That's right.
And they went in there, created that havoc in that society, separated the Muslim from the, gave away Pakistan, and then started creating this economical problem, right?
What's the documentary called?
I can't remember. I just was flipping it. You guys, I saw it, you know, on YouTube.
Yeah.
Because now we go, she was telling me about that program, Judging Freedom, and then I see it. You know, I finished watching that documentary, and that come up just like that.
Right. That's right. This is an eye opener for us, you know. And the key to this, one of the keys to this, after Allah's intervention, is that relationship between the rulers and the scholars. So, without that support that was given by the Muslim government, that scholars could not have done what they did, the Bayt al-Hikmah and the things that they did. And that's what Muslims, you know, need today, is, you know, for our governments and those in authority to stop wasting money on big yachts and palaces and things like this, and use the money properly to defend other Muslims, for the advancement of scholarship, you know, for taking care of the poor. You know, there's so much that we can do, okay, once we get in line the relationship of rulers to the scholars. So we're going to close the class here, and inshallah, next week will be our last class, and it's going to be a very important one, you know, for me, because I want to bring to you a scholar, another fusion scholar, who actually had both. And you'll see the coming together of scholarship and leadership not too long ago. Okay, so we're only going to go a couple hundred years, not way, way back, and you'll see this amazing fusion next week, inshallah. So I leave you in peace. Wa akhira da'wana. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.